try to empower every individual volunteer. So giving them specific roles that were aligned with their wants and their goals was the best way.
Calgary Show Services presents the Event Planning Podcast, featuring interviews with industry professionals to help you produce your next event.
Well, here we are again. I'm joined by Adrian Erlacher at Kawa on 8th. You gotta try their cappuccino. How's it going?
Good, man. Yourself?
Good. Thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So mostly I wanted to talk to you about BIG, the Big Winter Classic. And its planning. Where did it come from, the original idea?
BIG was spawned in the summer, actually, and it was just called BIG. The idea of the Winter Classic really came from the idea of doing something in Calgary that would kind of showcase all of Calgary year-round. As we both know, summer is inundated with a ton of great festivals. So we were trying to find a way to become relevant year round. So we had our summer festival at Commonwealth in 2013, 35 performers, 15 artists, 5 venues. It was a very big success for us. So then we were trying to figure out as we got going, how do we keep this relevant? How do we keep BIG and how do we create a name? We were really a nobody to everybody at the time. So I kept thinking, geez, we have 8 months of winter and we have nothing going on. So hence the Big Winter Classic. And really the event side of things started as an idea to have some fun. We didn't really know where this would go. So many years of learning at this point.
What were some of the biggest challenges when planning a winter festival?
Well, I think when you're planning any event, you're dealing with a lot of volunteers. So commitment and accountability is always a challenge. Trying to be a leader and manage people in a scenario that's productive, but at the same time still trying to make sure work gets done. I'd say that's initially our biggest challenge. And then secondly, I'd say, this would be the first challenge, would be getting through the concept phase. You quickly realize a month has gone by and you've had 4 meetings and you spent about 8 hours and you're still talking about ideas. So I think it's having the wherewithal to say, hey, this is our concept, this is what we're going with. We do know there'll be moving parts, but you know, let's stop talking about the ideas and let's get moving. So it's getting past the idea phase and into action phase.
So how did you come up with the focus of the event?
It's a really good question. And again, I think that was something we transitioned through the idea phase into the focus phase. The focus of the event was presented at the get-go, but we added craft beer, I think, a month in, which came organically through our discussions. And I think we find inspiration, too, from other events. So for us, it was really on me to nail down exactly where we're going and how we're going to get there. I don't know if that answered that question, but I hope.
Going back to volunteers, how did you keep them accountable?
Well, all you can do is do your best. And I think that's through leadership and continued communications. We lost volunteers. We gained volunteers like last day. You know, as you know, we had great companies come on board. But I think as a whole, people are motivated and feel like they're part of the event and feel like they have some ownership of what we're doing is the best way. You get people roles that they're empowered in. We found that was easy. We really try to empower every individual volunteer. So giving them specific roles that were aligned with their wants and their goals was the best way.
And what kind of methods do you use to communicate with the volunteers? Did you have any technologies that you could suggest?
Whips, chains, shackles. No, actually, we use Slack. It was a page that we end up using. It's a communication tool. I'm not sure if you're aware of it. And then also, too, I think your communication to your volunteers needs to be very directed. It needs to be one sole person. Anytime you add clutter to everything, you lose people very quickly. So project management. We are very lucky to have a very strong project manager. So in communication with the volunteers, again, I think that's where you empower people too, is when you communicate with them directly instead of these mass emails. So although it seems like a lot when you had 25 volunteers, that was the best way to have that commitment. And again, I think for the whole festival, we had 2 volunteers, not no show. 2 out of 25. So I'd say that's a success on that side of things.
And did you hold pre-show and post-show volunteer meetings?
Yes, we did. We did an actual town hall for at the beginning. So what we wanted to do is bring in a bunch of potential volunteers and ask them what they wanted to do, ask them about their thoughts on the festival, ask them if they had any previous experience they might be able to lend to the festival in regards of how we do things. I think when you're doing something like this, we're constantly learning. So to be able to, again, it goes back to empowering them is saying, hey, we want your feedback right away before you even start. So we had a town hall, and then we deciphered from their schedules and roles and so on. And then we have, you know, we have a wrap party for all the volunteers as well. And as well, we sent out a survey. So that survey was meant to just ask internally what kind of things we could do, and the feedback has been excellent. So one thing I would suggest is a quick follow-up after any type of event you plan with all internal people, whether it be volunteers and or staff, and get their feedback and ask them to be as honest as possible.
You mentioned before the interview that you were doing a documentary on the event, and I was wondering, how important is it to capture the event through photography and video?
Oh, extremely important. That's our, it's gonna be our social channels and social feeds. The documentary may be a 44-minute, which is going to tell a very in-depth story on craft beer, arts, and music in Calgary. But realistically, that can be chopped up into 50 different ways. That can be used for our social media. That can be used for a teaser. That can be used for sponsorship. Very important. Images tell stories way better than you and I sitting here on a podcast. And then, no offense to the podcast, it's just, I think for us, is having these images is going to be super important to be able to show how good the festival was. So the people that were on the fence this year to buy a ticket, this is what's going to move them on. And again, this gives us content to use throughout the year.
So the capturing those images and video becomes fodder for promoting next year's event?
Absolutely.
So how did you initially promote the first one?
What would you suggest? 2016?
Or the 2013?
Oh, geez. I come from a marketing communications background. I won't lie. We begged, borrowed, and stealed. We knocked on doors of people we know. Again, having media contacts was a great advantage, even with our committee for this year. So I think we have a compelling story, too. Media is just not going to cover anything. So the difference with Big Winter Classic was we brought on a craft beer component that, hey, it's been done before, but it hasn't been done before, at the very least, in Western Canada. A music festival tied with craft beer. You know, that was a very interesting story. Craft beer and local business is obviously a major thing right now in Alberta, as you know, with the economy being the way it is. So being able to focus on those key items, too, was not just about the festival anymore. It was also about these local businesses and entrepreneurs that are coming together to work together on a festival. Those people are just as much partners as anybody else, so...
So what kind of roles did you have, like, within the Big Winter Classic? If you could just name, like, you know, you had the marketing coordinator, the volunteer coordinator. What other positions did you need to arrange for?
Well, we had a craft beer coordinator. We had media and public relations, budgeting and background. So obviously, and that was something that was, I found was very, very important, was making sure our budget was on par. Band manager, location scout. A lot of what we did was we created a core committee that would have certain titles like director or project management, and underneath that they had volunteers. So when our meetings would not be meetings of 15, 16 people, we'd have meetings of 4 or 5, and we're still able to make sure that we're getting actionable items done. So where are you at, you know, band manager? How many bands you booked? Where's our budget at? So, for us, those are things, too, that we learned a lot from this year. We've added probably 4 or 5 new roles to this upcoming 2017 festival already, and we're a year out. So,
what was the most stressful part of the event on the actual days? And how could you avoid it?
Hey, man, I, you know what? One thing I'll tell you, and I don't know if you're getting these answers from anybody else that runs events, I was relieved Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I cannot tell you how smooth the event went. The worst days for me were literally Tuesday, Wednesday, leading up to it. We ran into issues with the AGLC. We ran into issues with bylaw. Things are out of our control, but things that, you know, we got to, things that we now know we can work on ahead of time going into next year. The festival for me was one of the things I preached from day one, was that all of our members that were involved with planning this festival, when we get to festival time, I want you to enjoy the festival. You put in a lot of work. There's no reason to think that we can't get to that point where we're able to have a beer and watch the festival and enjoy. So I wasn't stressed during the festival. Actually, I really enjoyed the festival and had a lot of fun. Of course, a lot of running around and a lot of people to talk to, but really that's us representing the festival. So
Who would you suggest that people should contact to avoid the liquor licensing problems in advance?
Oh, that really depends on what kind of festival you're running. Are you not-for-profit? Are you an incorporation? Are you a sole proprietorship? When you look at all of those things, like for us this year, it's really the venue's responsibility. It's their license. But AGLC is very easy to reach out to. You can find that online anywhere. But again, my suggestion would be, unless you're in the liquor business, avoid it. Let the venues deal with it. They're generally, any type of public event is at a licensed venue or has, you know, again, it depends. If liquor is a mainstay of your festival, like craft beer, we've already brought on a new person next year to work with just AGLC and our venues and the beer. Like, that's something we'll definitely avoid next year, and we'll be done ahead of time.
So a lot of people listening might be booking their event in a community center and they have to bring their own booze in. But since you did use a venue that already had their own liquor license and whatnot, did you have to arrange a minimum with the venue? Like, we're going to sell this much, you know, to have this space as our venue?
That's a really good question. No, it would have been the other way around. I think we could have done a better job negotiating what we get from the deal. Originally, we wanted to sell all the craft beer. We had arranged all the collabs and all that stuff, and it worked out that literally the day before AGLC called and said, oh, no, you can't do that. We had already gone through, actually, to kind of retract on the last question, we had already gone through the steps of doing a buy and sell with AGLC. For whatever reason, unbeknownst to me, they fell through like the day before. AGLC was at both venues, meeting with both venue owners. So, you know, for us to put in the marketing efforts and book 55 bands and bring in 17 craft breweries, we really should have been expecting a kickback from the venues. These are venues that mid-January, end of January, were packed for 3 days and three nights. So I always view...
Inside and outside.
Inside and outside. There, the patios, it wasn't even cold. I'm worried about this winter thing.
So I guess... Since they were in those types of venues, then you weren't really concerned too much about security, as that was kind of the venue's responsibility. Is that right?
We did. You know what? Actually, one of the things that we did prior, and this was a big shout out to Charlie Hinton, who's the owner at Broken City, was that I asked him about security, and I said, hey, is there anything we can do? And he said, you know what? He goes, we've never been asked that. He goes, you know what? Our security would love a walkthrough. Our security would love to know your schedules, all that stuff. So... there we were a week later, meeting with the head of security at Broken City, who did security for both venues. We did walkthroughs, we did doors. So one thing that was easy as could be was security. I thought it was seamless. So we had and again, I think it was very beneficial to have our team meet the security team. They got to meet all our members. They got to know what we'd be wearing for wristbands. So there was never any holdup of getting from venue to venue if we needed to. So, yeah, security was a real bright spot for us. I thought it went really well.
What do you think was your best method of marketing? And did you measure how effective a specific type of marketing was in any way? Or?
Yeah, we did. We did a ton of analytics, obviously through social media and so on, which is stuff that we can gauge. You know, I thought our best form of marketing was us. Was getting out in the street, getting out talking to people. We did an extensive PR campaign, which got us in with, we were on 3 television stations, 4 radios. We were on CBC, CKUA, CJSW, and The Peak obviously gave us, and CJ 92. So again, I think the story was, it was just making sure we were out there. You know, we started the media campaign in November. Great bands, craft beer, are all great selling points, and bringing them together as one made for an interesting story. So
were you providing that story as a suggestion in the PR campaign?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we'd give background on who we are and what we are and what our goals were with the festival, and then outlining kind of the creative differences that we feel we have over the average music festival.
What kind of technologies did you use for ticket selling, social media, and calendar management?
So social media, Hootsuite, we used for all our analytics with all that stuff. We had a number of social media people working on the campaign. We use Google Docs. You know, it's easy, it's free, it's private, it helps us. And again, we use Slack. So Slack was our internal communications network, which does link to all social media channels. We use Nice. I don't know if you've heard of Nice. It's a storyboard site where you can create storyboards. And again, that just helped us create the visual feel for what we wanted to do. And Google Docs. and then basic email and text.
So it seems like it's developed into a pretty wide organization, and you're getting more people to fill these roles that you felt were lacking. So what would you recommend for somebody who's just starting out, who doesn't have a team with them? How can they manage things on their own?
Oh, I would actually spend the time. It might sound tedious, but I would spend the time writing down roles and responsibilities, regardless if it's just you, and they need to be clearly defined. If you can define what these roles are going to be, again, even if it's one or two people, it'll help you out greatly. And I think, to avoid this whole idea phase is that if it's one or two people come up with a concept and you're going to bring in other people, just have that concept clearly defined. Again, understand it'll always move. It's an event. That's what happens. But avoid the idea stage and get right into the action stage. You're bringing people in. If you can clearly define what your festival is going to be or what you want to achieve, that you're going to save a lot of time.
What about sponsorship? Did you have any event sponsors, and how did you approach them?
Yeah, absolutely. That would probably be my strength, my background in sales and marketing. We created a sponsor deck, and that was one of the first things we did. And again, this is very similar to your question with media and how do you get out there. We have a compelling story. People want to be part of compelling things. And something with sponsorship, that'll be something that grows every single year. You know, we're still trying to create a name, so... it's finding ways, and I think sponsorship needs to be a moving parts thing and not a rigid offering. I've always disagreed with this idea of platinum, titanium, gold, bronze, whatever those levels are for sponsorship. I've always thought that's a really silly way to do things, because 9 times out of 10 people are going to want to leave behind, or they're going to want you to email it to it, they're going to want to share it with their staff, whatever it is. I think going in with sponsorship and empowering people to say, hey, what's going to work for your organization? And then let's work on it. You know, you can come up with general costs of what a stage will cost, but maybe you want to do a custom stage, or maybe you want to do a custom brick wall of art like we had. That, you know, so I think going into sponsorship with an open door is always the best way to go about it.
Yeah, because you can provide a unique opportunity for that sponsor to promote their product to your patrons.
Absolutely. So Michelangelo Fine Art Gallery stage was a giant frame that they had custom built. Of course it works for them. They are a framing store. So but that was a different idea than saying, hey, you know what, Michelangelo, we'll give you a stage. It's going to cost you X amount of dollars, and we're going to put your name on it. No. Let's do something. Hey, that was the nicest stage we had, and it was easily the most photographed. Like, if you look at all our photographs, like, you know, those things are compelling to people. And that's subliminal branding. You know, that's marketing she couldn't buy if, you know, she went out and spent $20,000 on a month of radio. You know what I mean?
Plus, the people that attended the festival are associating that experience with their company and the great time that they had at Big. It's a feeling that they had associated with it instead of, you know, some other form of marketing.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny with marketing, there's no real science. I know you can pull analytics from social media. Does that mean it equaled sales? I don't know. Does it mean, you know, will someone ever walk in your store and say, hey, I saw your ad in the Herald, I want to buy this couch? Probably not.
Yeah.
But things like when people do think about framing, they're going to remember 3 days of Michelangelo. It's just been embedded in them. So I think finding ways to engage sponsors is the best way. Hey, look, there's always going to be that sponsors like, here's $10,000 and we want to be a title sponsor and put our name on things. I would much rather work with a sponsor that wants to be part of the festival and has some goals in mind or ideas. Let's hear them. So that's where ideas come in, is when you're sitting down with someone and saying, yeah, I want to own a stage. Okay, how do we make that stage special?
What which event have you attended that you thought this is the most amazing event, and what was it about it?
Oh, geez, that's a really good question. So it's really funny. I find my inspiration for events nowadays are through are as a voyeur. You know, Bright Winter in Cleveland is a festival that we really aspire to reuse as motivation for this year's Big Winter Classic. There's tons of local, you know, again, I think engagement and experience is always the greatest thing, the way of looking at things. Austin City Limits on the music side was a festival that I went to that I always admired for the fact that you walk through the gates and as an adult, you can get a beer anywhere and walk around. Families, kids, no violence, no wait in line for a bathroom. And there's 100,000 people. How do you achieve that? I think, you know, avoiding, the reality is we have a few laws here that are maybe a little different than down in the U.S. or in Texas for that. You know, but I've always been in awe of going to Folk Fest and having to go stand in the cage with kids and wait in line and not be able to, you know, like, it just, it blows my mind. And that really takes the experience for me. So
it would be nice if the government would empower their citizens to behave responsibly by loosening up some of the liquor laws. Like,
yeah.
When you go to Europe, you don't see people abusing themselves in public, you know, or I haven't personally experienced anything like that. And, you know, why not empower your populace to behave responsibly?
It creates chaos. I literally, a quick anecdote, I went to the Virgin Fest at COP years ago when Pearl Jam was playing. And we went there all day. It was a really hot day. You had to buy a ticket outside the cages for beer. You had to get ID to go into the cages for beer. You could only buy two tickets. And you just watched the anger mount and mount and mount until Eddie Vedder stopped the concert halfway through and goes, you got to let these people out of these cages, because the one beer gardens was actually up on the side of the hill. And he stopped the concert. He goes, people are going to get hurt because people are just crammed up against these cages. All these, like, man, let adults be adults, especially if we're going to make alcohol a legal commodity. You know, like,
yeah.
It makes no sense to me.
And also people might be quickly consuming their alcohol because they're, you know, they want to catch a buzz and, you know, go see the band that they enjoy instead of casually drinking and watching the band and enjoying both things at the same time.
Or I want two beer really quick so I can go back and wait in line to get tickets, go wait in line, come back. It makes no sense. And even from a revenue stream, it makes no sense. Like, let people, you're right. Like, I just think let people be people. And again, we're getting better at it. I believe that there's specialty licenses now available in Alberta that will allow for open drinking. To that, you have to staff it with a certain amount of security, and you have to have a certain amount of porta potties and so on. You know, my understanding at Folkfest is that they have the ability now to open it up. But again, I think there's a financial, I think they'd triple their sales and alcohol myself if you let the
security and maybe environmental effect too if people are throwing their cups around. But I mean, the Folkfest is so nurturing, the community
exactly
is so loving. Like, if you were stranded on a desert island and you could only have one meal every day for the rest of your life, what would it be?
I'd have to be, I'll have to go old school. It'd be steak and potatoes because it's just easy. You know, I'd love to say sushi, but I don't know if I could eat sushi every day, all day.
And where can people find out about the festival and yourself on the internet?
BigWinterClassic.com. We are on a break right now, but we will be back soon enough. And TheMorningRoastCollective.com is my website for my personal company, which we do marketing and communications here in Calgary.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening. This podcast was produced by Duncan Kenworthy, Eric Jesse, and Chris Benoit. Visit us online at CalgaryShowServices.com to join our monthly newsletter for inventory updates and event insights.